It's my pleasure at this point to introduce one of our board members at the Burton K. Wheeler Center and one of the panelists from the first session this morning, Bob Brown, again, longtime Montana politician, who will be introducing our keynote speaker for this lunch session. So thanks so much, and here's Bob Brown.
Thank you. Eric's got such a long neck that I... Well, it's my great pleasure to make this introduction. The man I have the honor to meet has a history with me that goes back for decades. And kind of a funny story to begin with. My grandmother, who's been deceased for many years now, lived in Kalispell when Pat was first running for Congress. And his theme was door to door. Now, heck, I mean, that's passé now. All politicians go door to door. But then it wasn't so much that way. And when you'd hear his commercials, it'd be ding dong like a doorbell. And it was effective and it worked well for him. And usually his campaign got the word out before he'd come to a town that Pat would be going door to door that day. And he spent months doing it and covered lots of doors and lots of territory. And one of the people whose door he knocked on was my grandmother. And his name was Pat. And he's friendly. Well, a friendly Pat is probably Irish, right? Well, that was a good thing if you were my grandmother. And even though she leaned Republican, although I don't think she was ever particularly solidly Republican, she voted for Pat for the rest of her life. Just on the basis of that, he made a really good impression on her. And so she just told me, well, Bob, I don't know. And I said, yeah, I think he is a good guy. And she said, well, I'm voting for him anyway. So, And then when I became a teacher, later on, Pat, of course, had also been a teacher, I don't remember quite how we worked this out, but he contacted me or I contacted him, and he brought a flag that had flown over the Capitol building to Big Fork High School. Now, I've since learned that there was so much demand for flags in high schools all over the country that the members of Congress would blow a bunch of flags into a helicopter and fly them over the... I don't know if that was the kind of a flag I had, but anyway, he brought a flag to Big Fork High School and presented it to the school in an assembly, and then he spoke to my American government class after that was over and just did a great job. And we have that history, and then our friendship was renewed when, after I lost the race for governor, I joined Pat at the University of Montana. And we were first at the Center for the Rocky Mountain West, and then I left there and went over to the Mansfield Center. But our offices are right across the hallway from each other for about 4 years at the Center for the Rocky Mountain West, and we had lunch together frequently and had lots of conversations. And he's a good man with a good heart, and he's going to give us a good talk today. Pat Williams.
Bob, you remember when we were young and we'd see each other occasionally at a political event or a convention or a good conference like this, and I'm sure you recall that during those conferences there was one thing that never failed, and that was that old men used to introduce old men to speak. Hadn't changed a bit. Thanks, Bob. I really appreciate your invitation. Seriously, I do. I don't get very many anymore, so I appreciate it. Oh, I speak a few times a year, but, you know, that's different than a few times a day, so... people that I used to campaign, by the way, on that campaign Bob mentioned, the first campaign, door-to-door for Congress, door-to-door for Montana, it took not just many months, it took 2 years, and we went to 67,000 doors. Yeah, I have new knuckles. I had to get them all transplanted, and I got new. But some of the people that have been helping me for all that time and working in the Congress or back here, not just in campaigns, but helping the people of Montana, a couple of them are here, and I want to point one of them out. You always get in trouble when you do this, but I want to point one of them out, and that's Sandy Oetzinger. Sandy, put up your hands so they know who I'm embarrassing. Good. Sandy's a former elected official from Lewis and Clark County, and so some of you I know have stopped to say hello to her and know her. When you elected me to Congress, I stole Sandy from Vice President, who was it? Yeah, Mondale. Fritz Mondale was Vice President. Sandy was working for Mondale, and she came up the hill to work for me. And after, I guess, this is the way I remember it, Sandy, after a few weeks or probably months, I asked Sandy if she'd come to Montana for a little while to meet some of the office staff in Montana. Every member of Congress has staff in their district, their state, and wanted to meet them and then get to know a little bit more about Montana. Now, I think that was in 1980 or 81, and Sandy came out to Helena and spent whatever it was, week and a half, and called me up and said, I'm not coming back. So what are you talking about, you're not coming back? She said, I'd love to go to work for you out here, but I have now seen Montana. Seriously, she said, and I've seen Helena, and I'm not coming back. She had come back, but only to load up her stuff and move out here. She was too valuable to lose, so we hired her out here. That's the kind of people you attract. And this state attracts, and it's really important. So I want to say, maybe for the benefit of the three or four people I'm referring to here, that you're going to see me do something unusual today, and that is, in part, read a speech. My staff knows that I just used to make notes on the napkins and speak from those, but this is a particularly important subject. I haven't spoken about it publicly for about 10 years, so I wanted to do it with some precision. My difficulty is that I couldn't get the type enlarged, and so I might be doing this. I apologize for that. I never met B.K. Wheeler. He passed away, I think, three or four years before I got to Congress. But it's my fault I never met him, because I was in Washington prior to getting elected. I was back and forth a little bit, of course. And I should have gone by and see if I could meet him, because he's one of the giants in Montana and American history. And you can't say that about all of our senators. You certainly can about Mike Mansfield. But BK and Mike and a couple of others were international giants. And you have the chance to meet an international giant, and you don't do it because you got to get the next plane out. And so I never met BK, but I knew his son Ed, who I liked. Ed and I tried to do business together, and I've met some of the family since I've been here. And I want the family to know that when Burton got off the train in 2009, in Butte, he was from Massachusetts, and he got a law degree in Michigan, and he decided to come west. He'd always had that thing that people have about going west. So, if you're coming west, you might as well go to Butte in those days. So he did. And he stepped off the train into almost waist-deep snow. Yeah, and thought, what the hell am I doing here, anyway? And so he stuck around for a couple of weeks and couldn't get a job with a law firm, so he was going to leave town. And the train was delayed. And so BK, by then having become a kind of a Butte guy, looked for a poker game. And he went over in a bar and in the back and played poker. And he lost everything. And the deeper he got into his pocket, the more he thought, I got to recover from this. So, you know, that's what happens with gambling. He lost everything, including apparently some goods. You know, he unloaded his suitcase. Which is this worth? And he lost everything. He had to stay in Butte. And, so he stayed. And, to the end of his life, BK used to say, you know, I got hoodwinked. I got in a poker game, and there was a Sharpie there as a player, and he took all my money. And as a couple of you from Butte will verify, the Butte people never accepted that. They said, look, BK Wheeler was a marvelous lawyer, wonderful, funny man, an extraordinarily good senator, and a lousy poker player. So for the family, Butte just doesn't believe that thing about having been cheated over there. When I was elected by you and others 38 years ago to the Congress, I believed that for more than half a century, Americans had placed our support and trust in government, which at every level, including our federal government, had directed the will of the people in saving the world from the horrors of a despotic rule by Hitler and the Japanese warlords, and for good measure, rescued Americans and with them hundreds of millions of people around the world from the black hole of economic depression. Government did that. And when I walked through the doors of the Congress, that's what I was thinking about. Government's important, people like it, and I'm absolutely honored to be part of it. Throughout the 20th century, with few exceptions, the United States gained and kept our preeminent world position. In times of both hard-won peace and the horrors of war, we have been it. In being it, we have sacrificed but carried on, been shaken to our core but persevered. From Teddy Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson, FDR and Truman, through Eisenhower and Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, Reagan, Clinton and Obama. Each president carrying out as best he can the will of the people and as best he can the will of the Congress, has resulted in a people that I think have been well served by government at all level, certainly including the federal level. So, newly elected as a member of the federal legislative branch, I had been granted the right to try to make a positive difference in the lives of Montanans and Americans. Considering the lack of freedom for the majority of people in the world, my opportunity to be a cog in the wheel of our representative government, although only one out of 435 members of the House, had gifted me with the rare opportunity to assist at making law and otherwise adjusting the levers of governmental power. I'd been elected to a parliamentary institution which historically has reaffirmed its responsibilities with more success during two centuries than any legislative body in history. And Americans knew it too. Yes, I understood that government often needed reform and that we, the people, must be vigilant to guard against its excesses. But we also know that the division of our government into three bodies, executive, judicial, and legislative, has avoided the manipulation of any one of those branches. None can impose its own will, unfettered. Members of the House and Senate, certainly throughout my lifetime, had for the most part been mature sensible, and authentic, upholding that grand title, honorable. Of course, there were those among the public, although a clear minority back then, who did not trust the members of Congress, except, of course, for the ones that represented them. An interesting dichotomy. I agreed, however, with the words of the wonderful British journalist and commentator on Things American, Henry Fairley, who's dead now. He said, "It well may be true that our politicians," speaking as an American, even though he was British, "that our politicians are today among the few who really believe in anything at all." He said, "I have not reported politics for 31 years in 26 countries. To imagine that politicians are innocent and guileless. But equally, I have not reported politics for all these years in all these countries without being certain that politicians as such, however many individuals among them are venal or stupid, are nonetheless the most hopeful messengers of the American society's will to improve." Politics in the late 1970s and early 80s were messy, unpredictable, and complicated. It never conformed to everyone's definition of either accomplishment or candor, but decade after decade, Montanans and most Americans had trust in government at all levels, and in particularly believed in the federal government, and it had and would continue to do great things, both at home and around the world. Politics provide the engine to get things done through government. Was I so naive back then as to accept the notion that all the people in Montana or American were uncritical of the federal government? Of course not. Mark Twain, my favorite cynicist, referred to the Congress as our only Native American criminal class. But 50 years earlier, a former Speaker of the House, Nicholas Longworth, noted this: "We were unpopular when Lincoln was a congressman. We were unpopular when Henry Clay was a congressman. For the beginning of the Republic, it has been the duty of every free-born humorist to make jokes about us." By the time I got to Congress, it seemed that that duty had been taken on with gusto by every American, professional humorist or not. I'd come to a Congress interested in reform of its old procedures. The House of the late 1970s and 80s was very different from those earlier days of oligarchy-bound leadership with its rule of get along, go along to get along. It had been realigned by capable leaders such as Missouri's Dick Bolling and Montana's Lee Metcalf before Lee decided to leave the House and run for the Senate. Thus, because the old rules employing strict seniority had been changed, new members of the House at least had opportunities for legislative accomplishment as well as moving up into the leadership. During my years on Capitol Hill, then-Speaker Tip O'Neill oversaw the largest reforms in the rules of the House of any speaker in history. Tip was seen, I guess the image was a big, tall, fat, cigar-smoking, whiskey-drinking politician from South Boston. Tip used to say, "That's not true, I'm from Cambridge." But Tip O'Neill is one of the best people I ever met in both generosity, skill, being a reformer, not looking like a reformer, but those are the ones that can do it if they set their head to it. In the November election, the year I got elected, people had again voted in favor of Democrats to hold a majority in the House, a fact that meant continuing legislative opportunities for members of my party. My colleague and friend, Congressman Ron Marlaney, represented the state's Eastern Congressional District as a moderate Republican when first elected, a moderate Republican. Ron and I became good friends, although not political allies, except for those issues that affected Montana, either benefit or liability. And then we were shoulder to shoulder, of course. We both had seats on the House Interior Committee, which held significant jurisdiction over issues of special interest to Montanans, including federal lands. In addition, Ron held a seat on the Critical Agriculture Committee, and my other committee was at first Education and Labor, and later the Budget Committee. And we were pals. We haven't seen each other lately, but Ron and I were pals. We grew apart politically. He went from being a moderate Republican to being much farther right. And I went from being a kind of a, I don't know, working stiff, moderate Democrat from Butte to being a more, I moved left. I became a little more liberal. And I think that's what happens. I just think that's what happens. People are conservative, get more conservative. People are liberal or moderate, move in, and Democrats move more liberal. But my point to you is, Ron and I stayed friends. Okay? I'll get back to that, but let me do a brief glance at history. I got to do what I do in the classrooms. I got to take my watch off and put it in front of me so I, when it becomes 4 o'clock, I stop. Kids will, the students in my class have put up their hands. Mr. Williams, do you know what that buzzer was 15 minutes ago? Buzzer? I didn't hear a buzzer. So stay with me here. When was it that politics and policy in this country have been discussed, practiced, and enacted without a measure of disagreement among the people, including the elected? When was it that there was no incivility in our dealings with each other over policy issues about which we cared a great deal? In just 1 week, next Saturday, America will recognize the signing of the U.S. Constitution 229 years ago. It's a good month to be gathered and talk about what you're talking about. It rained that weekend in Philadelphia, but on that Monday morning, 17th of September, the sky had cleared, and on Chestnut Street, the elderly Dr. Benjamin Franklin was being carried to the proceedings in a sedan with two long poles carried on the shoulders of four men. Franklin was the oldest of the delegates at the convention. It was a group of the young. Charles Pickering was 29. Alexander Hamilton was 30. James Madison was an old man. He was 36. Madison was asked much later, well, not much later, but a few years later, to come and speak to a group. And he said, I remember people didn't live very long then. He said, nobody wants to hear an old man speak. He said, I'm out of ideas. He was 39. Yeah. For these final days in Philadelphia, which, by the way, had begun 5 months earlier, Dr. Franklin had written a persuasive speech in which he recognized the faults of the Constitution, which he was about to make a motion should pass. 5 months he'd been drafting this. Delegates from only 9 of the 13 states, colonies, were present. Of the original 55 delegates, only 39 signed the document, which then went directly to the individual states, of course, for ratification. The entire process was punctuated by disagreement, not always civil. There was anger and often fury. Those were the emotions expressed by the members in letters home and in later writing. From that historic point of origin, we as a people have debated, argued, discussed, shouted, calmly considered, and angrily railed about every policy change made in or by our government. We're still arguing about the Constitution. What does it mean? What did they intend? Don't we need more states' rights? Why did they have a big federal government? That's what they were talking about. I think maybe we ought to get on to something new personally, but it's how Americans are. We want to talk about these things for 200 years. And no, civility was not the order of the day back then, and it hasn't always been, of course, the order of the day. But in less than 10 months, 10 of the 13 colonies had ratified the new Constitution. Neither opposing interests nor local passions would stay the hand of compromise. But consider this. Neither did it still the disagreements about the basic organizational structure of our government. And as I say, we still fight about it. People sue about it all the time. It's not what the Constitution says. The Supreme Court's busy deciding all these all these matters. I think the founders intended that because they knew this document was malleable. Now as then, we continue a political climate that results in political figures being subjected to relentless attack and occasionally praise as well. But just witness the current turmoil of this year's election season. Not even our earliest, robust, bare-knuckled, ferocious street campaigns of two centuries and more ago were filled with the kind of anger, distrust, fear, and coarseness that has plagued this presidential campaign. It is, I think, a reflection of Americans, some of them, some who make that slim majority for an election, you know, give you the margin. I think it is a reflection of those people who are the most supportive or defensive. But I do think there are huge pockets of people in America who have, in large measure, caused. Somebody said caused Donald Trump. But I think you can measure Hillary's responses to Trump as well as you can measure Trump's, what he's doing and saying. He says it. Hillary knows her people are angry at him. And some independents are who she hopes to get. So then she says, in a much calmer voice and without the crude language, terrible things about Donald. You may think those things are true or false, so that's not the point. They're both appealing to angry people. Eh. Politicians know how to appeal for votes, successful ones, right? Whether it's Bob Brown or Pat Williams or Bill Clinton or Ronald Reagan, they know how to do it. They don't make mistakes in appealing. So both Hillary and Donald are appealing, I think, to some of the wrong people. I have subscribed most of my adult life to a belief that, as Alexander Hamilton said about the Congress and the House, here, sir, the people govern, the people rule. And I would add, sometimes for the better, sometimes for the worse. But the people do rule. They do make politicians try to get their votes. Although the old adage, look, there's enough blame to go around, is certainly appropriate to your discussions today. It does seem to me that the blame here is not just on the American people individually. Some politicians, with their own disdain for government, the very government they're in, putting down the government, have caused, I think, a portion of the anger that we see and the distrust of government by the people. Politicians themselves do it and say it. Well, hell. Eighteen years in the Congress does at least two things for a person. First, it really focuses one's thoughts. And second, it sure muddles one's thinking. So, you know, there's an uncertainty about which came first, the chicken or the egg. Is this the politician's fault or the people's fault, or what is it? It's a muddled kind of thing. For those members of Congress who are genuinely curious, a serious question inevitably occurs in both the Republican and Democrat cloakrooms just off the floor of the House. We sit and sometimes have really good conversations in there, waiting for a vote. And here's the question that has bugged members of Congress for a long time. Am I elected to tell my constituents yes or no? What if my constituents are dead wrong about this? They just don't know enough about it. But if I could go out and talk to them in groups of 50, and I could take a year to do it, you know, they'd see it differently. So do you vote no on what your state wants? Or are you elected to represent people that are good? I don't think Montanans still remember this, but Senator Mike Mansfield was the leader in writing the first gun control laws and pushed like hell for gun control. And when he'd come home, I remember being with him we didn't serve together, but I knew Mike and I traveled with him a little. We were in Glasgow, and Mike got up and gave a speech, and people thought he was in big trouble about gun control in Montana. But he was running for re-election. He got up and gave a nice 15, 20-minute speech to a crowd a little smaller than this in Glasgow, a breakfast crowd, and never mentioned gun control. Never mentioned it. But when he finished, he said, well, that's all I have to say about those three topics, which are very important in America and are going to be before the Congress, before the Senate. He said, and I may have missed a thing or two that you want to talk about, so shoot. So he said, no, they elect me. I asked him, I said, you know, went to Japan to visit with Mike when he was ambassador. I said, are we elected to, you know, his wife is from Anaconda and still has some family around Anaconda in Butte, so we have connection with him. I said, Mike, do you think we're elected to say yes or say no? He said, no, we're elected to do what we think is best. And we pay attention to people, because if we think this is good and they don't, we better check it over again. So he said, we do that. He said, look, Pat, I get elected to use my head. So I went back there and used my head. Sometimes Montanans agreed with me, sometimes they didn't. And I would always say to them, look, in this system, if you really don't like what I'm doing, bring me home. Don't vote for me next time. Well, you know, there aren't four politicians in America could have got away with that. But Mike had a way about him. But that has been an enormous question in the Congress. One's answer to that question, I think, depends on your definition of leadership and how you lead people and how you try to convince them, how you explain things. There's an old political adage, you have to explain it, you're going to lose. But I didn't find that to be true. The larger question goes to, where is the greatest influence? Is it with the people? Here, sir, the people govern, the people rule. Or is the preponderance of authority with the three branches of government? The point is essentially this. If, in fact, we live during an especially uncivil, angry, crude, and untrusting political period, whose fault is it? Elected and appointed officials? Or the people? or both. When I began my service in the House, I was very pleased to quickly understand that one made friends on both sides of the aisle. The Republican leader was a fellow named Congressman Bob Michael from Illinois. He was the minority leader. Democrats were and had been in the majority when I got there in the House for 40 years. People had elected Democrats in the majority. The minority leader's name was Bob Michael. He was from Illinois. And one of the nicest guys I ever met, one of the most thoughtful, considerate, compromising guys, got stuff done. The Speaker of the House was the Democrat Tip O'Neill. Tip O'Neill, Bob Michael, and Tom Foley, who later became Speaker, are among, oh, and I want to add Bob Dole and Ted Kennedy on the Senate. They're probably the nicest, most informed, gentle, but determined people I've ever met outside of Montana. And I've spent a lot of time outside of Montana, although I've always lived here. It was an interesting thing to me that although friendship reigned in the House, and partisanship certainly existed, as it absolutely must, but we were friends one to another. But I found it interesting that I began to notice a genuine difference between my opinion of the Republicans with whom I served and my Democrat constituents. I had both, you know, independents, Democrat, Republican constituents, but my Democrat constituents did not like the Republicans that I would talk about favorably. And they would tell me to my face after a speech, what in the hell are you saying something like that for about Bob Dole? Bob Dole's a snake. Bob Dole's, Jesus, calm down. Do you know Bob Dole? Republicans were livid about Ted Kennedy, who's one of the great senators of all time. Now, I know Teddy had his faults. Yeah, they damn near all do. Just not as many as Teddy, but they... Teddy is a great guy. Apologized for his wrongdoings, changed his life, and became one of the great senators of all times. Montana's Republicans were absolutely furious about Ted. They wanted him to go to hell in the morning. You know, I mean, it was amazing to me, the anger about all that. But I established my own working relationships, and some of you will recall these names. I already mentioned one of them, but there are two of them. But my working relationships included people such as on the Republican side, such as Bob Dole and Bob Michael, the minority leader, and Henry Hyde, who women are still angry at Henry Hyde. He had the Hyde Amendment, which was the limit on abortions, which is still in effect today. That was 40 years ago he put it into effect. But Henry was a really nice guy. He was wrong as hell about some things, but talking about his personality and his generosity, he was a really nice guy. And a fellow named Dick Armey. I don't know if you remember that name. Dick was a controversial member of the House. Not a hard right winger, but pretty conservative. What I liked best about him is he taught economics at the University of Montana. And I said, you taught economics? He said, yeah. I said, for how long? He said, well, you know, I taught conservative economics. I only lasted about a year. Missoula. My constituents didn't care for any of those people, and I was told, quit referring to Ron Margonet as your friend. I said this yesterday. My constituents were more partisan than I was. And I had a lot of, I'm pretty partisan. But I'm not mad at anyone. My constituents were angry. Not all of them, but enough of them to get your attention every time it came to Montana. So I think it was Michael Jackson had a song, something my kids used to listen to, something about in the mirror, the man in the mirror. Look at the man in the mirror. Look at the woman in the mirror if you want some answers to why things are going right or why they're going wrong. And we need to do more of that as a people. I'm skipping some of this because I don't want to overkeep you. But it's great stuff that I'm skipping. I think a large number of citizens across Montana, as a decade or more went by, became more and more cynical, certainly than their elected officials. But it wasn't long before their elected officials either changed their thinking about government and became more cynical, or new officials were elected, and they were elected because they preached cynicism. That's who you vote for if you're cynical. And so the Congress really began to change. By the way, I say this as a pretty partisan Democrat, but I told you the Congress for 40 years, people had elected a Democrat majority for 40 years when I got there and stayed a while. 40 years. I say, as a Democrat, that's too damn long for any party to control something like the House of Representatives or the U.S. Senate. It's too long. And you know what you get? Lazy. And you know what you do? You start, I don't mean this physically, but you start double parking, right? I have the authority to do this. And you start saying, to hell with the opposition. And there were members of the Congress that were very strong people, none of whom I've mentioned today, they were chairman of powerful committees. They abused their Republican colleagues. I watched it for three terms. Abused them. Wouldn't hear their bills. Wouldn't see them in their office. I mean, it was unfortunate. It was damning and dangerous. People begin to see that, too, and kind of thought, maybe it's time to change. And who came riding into that void? Here's a name that you'll remember. Who came riding into that void? Newt Gingrich. Here he comes. And I'll refer this way to Newt. There are very few people I've met that I didn't like. And I don't like saying it, but it's true. Newt, and it's not because of his brilliance to organize and the fact that that the Gingrich Congress was the first one in 40 years to be a Republican. It doesn't have anything to do with any of that. It had to do with the sudden and dramatic change as the Democrats lost the majority, the sudden change in how we felt about each other. It wasn't the Democrats were hard losers. It didn't have to do with that. It had to do with the fact that Republicans in Washington, the organizational Republicans, not necessarily around the country, allowed Gingrich to establish the methods under which the Congress would change hands. And so he started a group called GOPAC, which had near illegal or maybe some illegal activities in raising millions of dollars, and they were spending that to defeat, you know, more moderate people, elect people on the fringe successfully. Gingrich came up with a dictionary about how you speak. And I've got a copy of a couple of pages over here. Listen to this. Tired yet? Listen to this. It's from Newt to his members. Often we seek hard words to define our opponents. Sometimes we are hesitant to use contrast, but we must remember that creating a difference will help you get elected. So below are powerful words that can create a clear and easily understood contrast between you and your Democratic opponent. Apply these to your opponent, their record, their proposals, and their party generally. And let me just read you some of the words that, and they used it. They the especially new people running, they'd take this and memorize it and use these words. Decay, failure, destructive, sick, pathetic, liar, liberal, traitor, hypocrite, radical, incompetent, destructive, self-serving, greedy, bizarre. And then just for good measure, Newt added in a press conference one time, Democrats are the enemies of normal Americans. Somehow it worked. Democrats didn't need to continue control all that time, but they shouldn't have lost it this way, because it poisoned the country. And as bad, when those new members came in, they believed that we were the devil. There was no more throwing your arm around a Republican or a Republican throwing his arm around a Democrat crossing the aisle saying, how are you, old pal? How was the break? Did you go home? Or, buddy, you gave a great speech in the well. I don't agree with it all, but you're a great speaker. No more. It was over. It's almost like there was a fear between the members. And it was sad. It saddened me because the place had been, you know, wonderful. It all stopped. Bang, stopped. And we didn't talk to each other. We stopped. Now, I understand this is harsh. And it's also something that happened in the Congress and across the country to a degree. You've read the letters to the editor the papers are now refusing to print, but have been for 20 years. It went across the country. And it worked. In the election of 92, as I say, Republicans took over the majority of the U.S. House. It's okay. It's just not okay the way it was done. This manner of campaigning greatly appealed to a brand of conservatism. Today, conservatives sort of came from that era are referred to as the Republican base. When you hear the announcers or, you know, the talkers on TV, the Republican base, well, they're referring to these people. Now, occasionally they'll say a Democratic base, but they can't define that. They don't know what the hell it is. But they do know what the Republican base is, and that is they'll turn out to vote every time. And they'll always vote for the most almost always vote for the most conservative person on the ticket. And it's millions of people. I tell you this because it accounts for what I saw as the end of many decades of civility in the United States Congress during what I will refer to as the Gingrich years. Friendship was replaced with fear. Friends across the aisle suddenly disappeared. Distrust became deep and overwhelming for the members of the House. No more handshakes. Seriously, no more handshakes. What the hell? We couldn't shake hands. I know it sounds extreme and extraordinary and it couldn't happen, but I was there. I watched it happen. Oh, occasionally you'd see a friend that you knew who got reelected and you'd say, you know, good luck, buddy. And a couple of them said to me, I'm sorry we beat you guys the way we did. And some of them were, you know, happy about it. I get it. The newly elected Republicans really believed the words in the Gingrich dictionary. I served another couple of terms, and then I left the Congress under my own power and came home to Montana to start teaching again, this time at the University of Montana. I'm saddened to say that in the almost 20 years since I came home, this has not gotten any better. The anger of the few Gingrich years has mellowed. That's true, and the words are softer. But the discontent is still there, and we see it in the presidential campaign and in the lack of turnout in recent elections. Up on the Rocky Boy Reservation, which usually has a pretty good turnout, last June in the primary, their turnout was 9%. I mean, that's like nobody voted. Some of the reservations did better, but none of them were tip-top like they used to be. So what does this lack of friendship do? I mean, I'll close with this. It means there's no trust, a lack of trust. 50% of a group can't distrust the other 50% and get anything done. Even if it's 60-40, you can't get anything done. You got to have trust. Trust is the fuel in democracy's tank. Think about this. When you drive home, you will go through a green light at the intersection, trusting that the person on red will stop. It's an American deal. If you've been to Europe, you've been to Italy, great places, but Jesus, huh? I don't know how many hundreds of billions of dollars of checks are cashed in America. A damn piece of paper with lines on it says there's a bank there, and you cash your check and you hand it to somebody. You know what they do? They give you money for it, or they'll lower your bill. Right? And send you a receipt, give you a receipt. Oh, that's trust. Imagine if that started to falter. What that'd do to the economic system. This lack of trust is a serious thing in America, because trust is the mortar between our bricks. And when it starts to disintegrate, we are in deep trouble quickly. And we may be falling in that hole now. I worry about it. When Ben Franklin got up to sign his name, he shuffled up to the desk. And he signed his name, and James Madison said, I was near him when he was signing, and he cried. He said, Dr. Franklin cried. And he went back and sat down, and when the last vote was cast, and they moved the draft of the new Constitution to the states for ratification, when it was over, Franklin pulled himself out of the chair, I think with a little help, some historians say, and he pointed at the chair that the president of the convention was sitting in the front of the room. The president of the convention was that old soldier, George Washington. And on the back of this high back chair was the image painted of a sun, rising or setting, a sun with, you know, some rays coming off. And when Benjamin Franklin rose, here's what he said. If you ever wanted to know anybody in your life, wouldn't it have been Ben Franklin? Jesus. He said, I have often and often in the course of these sessions looked at the painting on the chair of the president, and I have often wondered if that was a rising sun or a setting sun. He said, since I heard the vote announced, and we have passed this Constitution on to the people, I with great happiness say it's a rising sun. We've got to get that attitude of compromise and value and better days ahead back in our sling. Thanks.